I'm Jen Taylor Skinner, and this is The Electorate. On this episode, I have a conversation with professor and author Dr. Crystal Littlejohn. And you may remember Professor Littlejohn from an earlier episode of The Electorate when she joined me to discuss her first book titled Just Get on the Pill, The Uneven Burden of Reproductive Politics. But she joins me today to talk about her new book titled Fighting Mad, Resisting the End of Roe v. Wade. Professor Littlejohn edited this collection of essays alongside historian and author Dr. Ricky Solinger, whose work you're probably familiar with, as she's written a number of books on reproductive rights. And honestly, I cannot think of two people who are more suited to bring us this new collection of essays on reproductive rights. In this 52-essay collection, they've brought together some of the most brilliant thinkers, scholars, and activists to write what I think will be a classic piece of literature, marking this pivotal and challenging moment in our fight for reproductive justice. The essays explore how we think about reproductive justice in the context of our carceral system, for example. They explore it in the context of the disability community and in the Asian American community, even what reproductive justice looks like in the heartland. We also talk about President Biden and how our political leaders should address abortion when it may or may not align with our personal or religious views. We explore it all. So please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Crystal Littlejohn.
Dr. Crystal Littlejohn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm always so excited to talk to you because our conversations are so great. But your new book, it really took me aback. It's really incredible, right? Because you have a collection of essays by some of the most brilliant thinkers and writers and leaders. And it's really timely and it's really necessary. It's titled Fighting Mad, Resisting the End of Roe v. Wade. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you so much. And I'm so glad to be back. I always love talking with you. So thanks for having me again.
Yeah, I mean, when I started reading this book and this collection of essays, I just thought, when I finished it, I just thought, I can't believe that this book has not existed before now, right? It's just so needed right now, especially considering I think we're about 2 years out from the Dobbs decision. And we could have used this book. I'm not saying you should have read it earlier, but I mean, we really need this right now. And I really hope everyone picks up a copy. But that opening essay for me is so powerful. It's titled Disability Dobbs and a Black Perspective. And it's by Erica Ayodele Dixon. And it highlights the gap between who we thought Roe v. Wade protected and who is actually protected. It's one of the best illustrations of that because it's only through the lens of reproductive justice that you can see how Roe failed the disability community and how we all failed the disability community, right? So can you talk a bit about that essay and the author for me?
Absolutely. So we really wanted to open up with this essay because of the very reasons that you were just mentioning, right? Getting us to understand that when we're thinking about abortion, when we're thinking about people's access to being able to create the families that they want to create, we have to be really mindful of the importance of having both a reproductive justice perspective and a disability justice perspective. And I think that Dixon's essay in the book just does such a fantastic job of capturing that for us, especially for people that may not be aware of what a disability justice perspective entails. And so one of the big things with Dixon's essay is this notion that folks that are disabled and also folks that just are steeped in reproductive justice activism know about the ways that the state has actively contributed to violating the rights of disabled folks. And so thinking about the Dobbs decision and how it overturned Roe v. Wade from the perspective of disability justice really calls on people to consider the fact that the state has long violated people's bodily autonomy and to think about the ways that that is intersected with their ability status. And so Dixon really talks about the ways that historically there have been eugenic narratives undergirding reproductive politics in the United States and how these things were sanctioned by politicians, judges, policymakers, etc. And so when we're thinking about how to uphold abortion rights, it's really important that in the process of doing that, that folks not advocate for eugenic ideas that are focused on genetic purity and ableist ideas about the kinds of babies that people should be having. And so we really wanted to open with this essay to reflect the idea that the fight for abortion rights, as it is based in reproductive justice, also has to be based in disability justice, so that our fight for abortion rights is just on multiple fronts, and so that people don't either intentionally or inadvertently end up perpetuating eugenic logics as they're advocating for the right for people to have abortions.
Right. And that's why the reproductive justice lens is so important in this context, because often historically when we talk about abortion rights, we just talk about the right to have abortion, right?
Right.
Which leaves out the history of the disability community, because often you mentioned, you know, eugenics, they have been, as an example that's mentioned in this essay, had forced sterilization, right? That also falls under the umbrella of reproductive justice. It's not just access to abortion that's included in that lens, but it's access to have a family in the way that you envision. I mean, can you explain more about what reproductive justice is? I've talked about it before, but a lot of people may not understand the distinction.
Absolutely. So reproductive justice is a term and a movement that refers to the right to have a child, not have a child, and to parent the children that people have in safe and healthy communities. And it's a term that was coined by Black women activists in the 1990s. And it's really been spread across the world using a human rights framework by a number of different reproductive justice and reproductive rights organizations. And the big thing to think about when it comes to people's access to abortion, particularly for marginalized folks, is really remembering that for people to live self-determined lives when they are coming from marginalized backgrounds, we have to focus in part on abortion as one resource that they need to be able to live the self-determined lives that they want to live. But we also have to think about the broader social context that prevents them from being able to have children when they want to have children, and to also being able to protect their children by allowing them to grow up in safe and healthy environments without the threat of violence, without the threat of police violence, with access to affordable housing, etc. And so when we're thinking about this from a reproductive justice perspective, specifically when we're grounding it back into the disability justice framework, it means that it's really important to think about the ways that Black folks, disabled, queer, trans folks have had their ability to create their families really encroached upon by the state. So in terms of having people being forcibly sterilized, having people's bodies be experimented upon, all of these things are fundamental to their experiences with reproductive justice. And so even as we have to fight very strongly for them to have access to an abortion, we also should fight very strongly alongside them to make sure that disabled folks have a right to self-determination and have the same right to bodily autonomy that anybody should have, but that folks that are espousing eugenic logics use to argue for limiting the rights of people who are disabled to make their own decisions about how to continue pregnancies, whether to continue pregnancies, et cetera.
Speaking of the Black feminists that are behind the reproductive justice movement, I just want to mention that as the listeners go out and pick up this incredible book, Fighting Mad, they should also pick up Loretta Ross along with this, a companion. Her book, I think it's titled Reproductive Justice, an Introduction. Yeah. So there's another essay that I really love. It's titled We Too Have Abortions, Centering the Abortion Needs to Asian Communities. And the author, Sheila Desai, talks about her own experience in seeking an abortion. But what the essay really highlights is how Asian Americans are so often invisible in our social justice movement. And it's such a powerful essay. And she talks about the model minority myth, which so often comes up in these conversations about their invisibility. So can you talk about how the model minority myth hinders reproductive justice for Asian Americans?
Absolutely. And so one of the key things with a model minority myth that folks are likely aware of is that it assumes that that Asian folks are successful, right? That all Asian people are experiencing high levels of upward mobility if they are coming from lower income backgrounds, but especially, right, that they are actually from highly educated families, highly educated backgrounds, that they are financially well off. And so it really tries to advance this narrative that Asians are a model for other minorities to follow. And I'm using minorities because of the model minority myth. But the idea is that folks of color, folks from poor backgrounds, right, that all they need to do is just look to the practices of Asian folks so that they too can become successful if they're not, so that they too can achieve, quote unquote, the American dream. And what it's really based on is racism, right? It's really based in racist ideas about these essential characteristics of people, in this case of Asian people, as inherently being intelligent, inherently valuing education, inherently striving to become financially successful. And it perpetuates xenophobia, it perpetuates racism, right? By arguing that if folks do not achieve a quote unquote model minority status, right, because of their own shortcomings rather than because of structural inequalities that makes it where they can't achieve those things. And so when it comes to the model minority myth, how we really see that affecting Asian folks' right and access to reproductive justice is that it makes people believe that if all Asian folks are successful, if all Asian folks have access to resources, then they don't need access to abortion. They don't need help accessing abortion. And we know that that's just not true, right? And that's what Sheila Desai's essay really gets into so brilliantly in the book, in that there are all kinds of myths that people have alongside the model minority myth that negatively affect people's experiences, Asian people's experiences getting abortion. So when it comes to racial stereotypes, right, beliefs that Asian people might be trying to have an abortion because of sex selective preferences, right? Ideas, like I just said, that they don't need access to financial resources to get an abortion because of the myth that they are all financially successful and financially well off. And so when you put that in the context where we know from Desai's essay that nearly one third of low-income Asian American women live in states that enacted abortion restrictions after the Dobbs ruling, we can see that it just doesn't hold up to the facts, right? People might imagine that, as the model minority myth perpetuates, people might imagine that Asian American folks don't have access barriers. And as Sheila talks about, because of the lack of attention in the mainstream, people might not even think about Asian American folks as people that have abortions. And so we know that in order to make sure people have access to abortion and to the right to reproductive justice, we have to disrupt those narratives, right? We have to make sure, obviously, that we challenge the model minority myth, right? So that people stop believing in those kinds of racist mythologies that just like anybody with a uterus that could need an abortion, Asian American folks do need access to abortion. We have to make sure that we are disrupting myths and dispelling myths that suggest that certain groups of people are not in need of abortion. And I'd add here just as one last point that even this notion, right, with a model minority myth that all Asian American folks are well off or financially successful, right? The notion that people that are financially successful don't need abortions is also a myth, right? People across the spectrum have abortions and need access to abortions. And so there's just so many things about the model minority myth that perpetuate issues with access to abortion and that can really constrain people's right to be able to have an abortion when they need to. And so we're just so grateful to Sheila for writing this essay, right, so that we could really help people understand that even before the Dobbs decision came down, there were these errors in how people understood abortion and needs for abortion. And this was really an opportunity for us to dispel those false understandings and to give people the information that they need, right, to really understand what's going on.
Yeah, the model minority myth has been so, so harmful, right? And we all need to do our homework to understand the origins of that and the history of that and the intentions of the model minority myth, which was to kind of pit marginalized communities against one another.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
There's another essay here that, you know, really bowled me over. And it's titled How Dobbs Will Deepen the Traumas of Incarcerated People. And she talks about an incarcerated woman who was arrested and booked into the county jail. When she asked for an abortion, the doctor said, and this is what really bowled me over, "We don't do that here. We don't believe in that here." And something to the effect of, you know, "Children are blessings," right? Now, this happened in 2018. So this was, you know, Roe was still intact. Roe v. Wade was still intact. And I just found that kind of, well, I want to say I found it unbelievable, but it is kind of believable. But, you know, how were they able to legally deny an abortion to someone just because they were incarcerated?
Absolutely. I think this is such a powerful essay alongside all of the other essays in the book that really shed light on things that people may not have had any knowledge about. And as you said, may not have believed before, right? You just can't believe that this kind of thing happens sometimes, even especially before the Dobbs decision. And so what Dr. Shufrin really highlights in the book is the importance of recognizing how, because prisons and jails are oftentimes, right, they're out of public view, they might not have as much scrutiny, and it can allow them to really enforce their own policies. And as we saw in the book, sometimes those policies and those practices can be unconstitutional and can really limit people's incarcerated folks' ability to have access to the reproductive care that they had and have a legal right to. And so Shufrin in that essay kind of starts breaking down the different legal issues that can allow some of these loopholes to support unfair practices and sometimes unconstitutional practices in prisons. And so even though she was officially allowed to get an abortion because she was in the first trimester, she was actually eligible according to the jail's policy. But as we learn about in the essay, she was still subject to folks that were in the jail's own moral beliefs about abortions that said that having an abortion was not okay. And so in Dr. Shufrin's essay, right, she spoke to people across states and looking at their experiences in jails and prisons in liberal states, right? So really getting at this idea and dispelling this idea that the people that are suffering are only those that are coming from states that are most restrictive, right? And what her essay really shows is that even people that are incarcerated in states that are understood as having a more liberal context, even they have to contend with potentially having their rights to abortion access violated, and that this was before the Dobbs decision. So we can only imagine what might be happening for folks since the Dobbs decision came down.
So one of the really heartbreaking parts that I read in this essay was, you know, the person who's centered in this essay, she said at one point that the baby didn't do anything wrong, yet the baby will be treated like an inmate. And that was just heartbreaking.
Absolutely. And it really gets into, as we've been talking about in our conversation, right, the importance of reproductive justice as a broader framework, right, that deals with abortion access, right? But that also shows us how, as people and as marginalized people, people's experiences with abortion are connected to their reproductive lives, right, and to their family lives. And so in this case, right, we're talking about access to abortion, but as the essay talks about, a baby, right, could have to face horrible circumstances because of decisions that are made within the prison. And so we're talking again about whether or not people have access to raising their children in safe and healthy environments. And when prisons institute unfair policies and institute policies that can harm people's children, obviously they're not having access to reproductive justice, right? Obviously they're not having the ability to raise their children in safe and healthy environments. And so it just really underscores the importance of tying abortion to reproductive justice as a broader framework, instead of just thinking about abortion as a standalone issue that doesn't dovetail with the rest of people's lives, right? People need access to abortion, but they also need access to a full spectrum of rights that matter for their well-being and the well-being of their children and families.
So another really important essay in the book, it's titled Protecting the Heartland, right? And it's about abortion access in the heartland or in rural parts of the country. And that was written by, I think, State Senator Diana Sykes. And I like this essay because it really challenges how we paint women in the heartland with this really broad brush, right? We assume that people in rural parts of the country, we assume that they may not support abortion access, right? But that assumption doesn't align with the data because there are more women in the country who support some access to abortion than don't support access to abortion. So can you tell me a little bit about that essay and why it's important?
Absolutely. So I think this is just such a fantastic point, right? People can make all kinds of assumptions about who does and doesn't support abortion rights. And I think that, as you say, people make this assumption that folks in Kansas would not be supportive of abortion rights. But what we see in the essay is that, in fact, the movement to fight against the constitutional amendment that would have created this ban on abortion was led by folks in the community, right? It wasn't spearheaded by the Democratic Party that led to this huge victory in getting the constitutional amendment rejected by the public. And so what stands out as being particularly important to me about that is that with Kansas, and I remember just kind of being on the edge of my seat when this is happening, right? They were the first state to hold a referendum on abortion after the Dobbs decision. And so everybody that knew about what was happening and that had been following it was kind of anxious to see what was going to happen, given that they were the first state to do this. And so, as the essay points out, the Kansans overwhelmingly rejected the constitutional amendment by almost 20 points. And it really stood as a testament to how important abortion rights are for everybody across the country, regardless of the ways that people might think about who needs or doesn't need abortion, or who advocates for or doesn't advocate for abortion, or who is for or against abortion, right? What it really showed us is that people in states, every single state across this country, need abortion, and that some of the most vigorous fights are happening in places that people might not expect. And so it was a huge victory for folks' right to abortion. And it was so critical that it took place because of a coalition of folks that were really joining together to fight for folks' access to abortion and to reproductive freedom.
You know, this book is so full. I'm just looking through, flipping through and looking at all the names here, the incredible writers you have here. You have an essay in here about how it's crucial in moving this debate forward that we move away from the binary, right? And it's titled Rejecting the Abortion Debate Binary and how that's essential to moving toward reproductive justice. And I want to talk about that because I think it's really important to the conversations that we're having right now in the midst of this 2024 election cycle, right? And it talks about how we need to move away from the debate being pro-life versus pro-choice. I mean, because it's not very helpful. And frankly, you know, in 2024, that's kind of immature considering how far we should have come in this debate. And I want to talk about it in a personal context because, you know, I grew up in the South. I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee. I went to a traditional Black Baptist church, New Bethel Baptist. Hello, Pastor Rogers. you know, and I grew up in an environment where having unlimited access to abortion wasn't something that they necessarily welcomed, but they supported it, right? They supported it from the standpoint of like, hey, everyone should have access to abortion. It may not align with my personal views, you know, and a lot of these people, a lot of the women that I grew up with, people that went to my church, I'm sure a lot of these people had abortions, but we still stuck to this idea that everyone should have access, regardless of what your personal religious beliefs are, right? And the reason I want to bring that up in the context of an election is because, and I don't know if you and I will agree on this, and that's what I love about having conversations with you. We can have these nuanced conversations.
Right.
But President Biden, I think, gave an interview recently with The New Yorker. He's given lots of interviews, obviously, because it's an election year. But he's been talking about abortion. And I think he's been talking about it from a similar lens in that he's Catholic. That's no, you know, that's no secret. Mm-hmm. And he often says things like, I'm not big on abortion personally. That's what he says personally, right? Mm-hmm. But it's important that we have leaders who, regardless of their personal views, they are able to understand that their personal views do not extend to all of us. Mm-hmm. And that we all should have reproductive justice. We should all mm-hmm. have access to abortion, and we should all be able to have the families that we envision. And I just think that this debate has lost that nuance, right? So mm-hmm. I think that that interview caused a lot of alarm.
Right.
But I don't know if it should necessarily, because a lot of people, you know, this is a very religious country, right? But it's also a country where the majority of women want access to abortion. Mm-hmm. There's some nuance there that I think we need to move towards. Like, how do we get to that nuance?
I love this question. I think it's just so important to think about, because and I love how you grounded it within in this kind of context of the binaries that we have. And I think for me, one of the challenges is I totally agree with you that it can be really powerful for people who, you know, have particular preferences to say, even if this goes against what I feel personally is right, I think it's important that everybody has access to something, right? Or everybody has the freedom to do something. I think that's really important, right? Because it can demonstrate that even when it's not, you know, of consequence directly to them, or it's not something that they believe would directly affect them, right? They still support it because fundamentally they think it's important, or in this case, right, fundamentally they believe it's not their right to impose their beliefs on somebody else. I think that's really, really important and can be really powerful. I think the challenge that I have when it comes to Biden is that I believe that even if you're going to take that stance, I think there has to be a really firm commitment and acknowledgement and a willingness to unequivocally demonstrate that regardless of your beliefs, you believe that something is fundamentally important. Just with some of the ways that he's gone about doing things, right, where he was refusing to say abortion, right, and how many times has he not said abortion? I think it's one of those things where in order for a person to believe that the right to have access to abortion is a belief that the Biden administration really holds to, I think that regardless of his personal beliefs, I think that it becomes especially important to make sure that there isn't any wiggle room for people to raise questions about that. And I think that when Biden doesn't say abortion and then accompanies that stance with this tendency to talk about his personal beliefs and how he doesn't believe in it or not, it is a bit uncomfortable for me, because I feel like if I just had a person who said, I don't personally believe in abortion, and said the word abortion, right? But I think that it's a fundamental human right that people should have protected, or that in this case, I shouldn't impose my personal beliefs on. I could be more comfortable with that. But when there's a tendency to kind of dance around abortion and the importance of abortion for people, and then to accompany that with language that refers to a person's personal beliefs in terms of not being a huge fan of abortion, as he can put it, I think that's where I think it becomes more problematic, right? It's not just a person's personal preference or his personal preference. It's the way that his personal preference is accompanied by a refusal to talk about abortion that I think can lead to stigmatizing it, and that can reinforce this narrative, right, that it's not something that's okay, and that a person's beliefs about whether or not it's okay should be part of the conversation. And so I think that's the problem that I have, that I think a clear message about the importance of abortion can get muddled when he doesn't talk about abortion explicitly and then accompanies the comments that he does make with caveats about his personal beliefs about abortion. And I think that's the tricky part for me.
Yeah, I mean, but do you think that is a healthy exercise for us to go through as a nation, right? Because, you know, we can see in real time someone kind of struggling with their personal beliefs, but yet still upholding what is justice for all of us, right? Because you'll have these conservative politicians who can't make that separation, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is a healthy example for the country to see someone who says, hey, listen, like what is personal is not necessarily justice for everyone. And we're going to have that debate in real time. We're going to have it publicly. Is that a healthy direction to take us, right? Or we can see someone struggling? Because I don't know why this came to mind, but mm-hmm. it reminds me of that kind of public struggle that I think President Obama had with, you know, same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. Is that similar or I'm maybe off base here?
No. I really think it's a fascinating and really important question. And so obviously there's not a right or wrong answer to this. So the challenge that I have with it is I do think that it can be important and demonstrative to see a person grappling with how to separate their beliefs from how to govern, right? And what's appropriate for governing other people's lives. I do think that could be helpful, right? And that might even resonate for people. I think the challenge that I have is that Biden has had a very long time to do that grappling. And I can't understand how at a time like this, when so many people are suffering, and we know how they're suffering, we know that folks that are pregnant are suffering, we know that folks that are forced to give birth are suffering when they have horrible outcomes of pregnancies that were known to be dangerous for the pregnant person or were known to be fatal for the child that they had. It's a real struggle for me to witness a person themselves struggling with something that to me feels like at this point it's hard to say should be resolved. It's not that I think that it should be resolved. I think that it's a struggle that has been ongoing. And so I don't understand how, given what so many people are experiencing now, I find it hard to follow why that struggle has to continue to be public and has to continue to be unresolved when the evidence of the violation of people's rights is so clear, and when we should know that a person's personal beliefs shouldn't be what is used to dictate the reproductive lives of other people. And I think especially one thing that I should mention here, right, is this is not just about religious freedom, right? Because even though, right, Biden as a Catholic has his own religious beliefs, and that's important, there are other religious traditions in which when we prevent people from having abortions, we're violating their religious practices. And so I think it's a complicated issue when we talk about the purposes that it can serve for resonating with people, for showing them the importance of separating the personal beliefs from political decision making. I think that can be helpful, but I also just worry that it does damage because it suggests that we should still be struggling with these questions that to me feel like should have long been resolved, right? In my personal opinion, I think that there is just so much evidence of the harms that are being done to people and of the harms that are being done when people's personal beliefs dictate what political decisions are made. And so when you have a conversation about what should happen politically, be constantly joined with a person's personal beliefs about how they believe that, you know, they wouldn't do it or something, I feel like it can just serve as a distraction that gets away from the core message that should be people are having their rights violated, people are suffering, and it shouldn't be happening. I think that's the core message. So when we start putting in individual opinions about things, it's a challenge. And obviously it's a challenge. It's a challenge to grapple with. I think, like I said, I think it's a super important question that people are going to have different opinions about. It's just, like I said, it's just difficult to me when I feel like the whole point is that we shouldn't be focusing on what individual people feel and believe, right? We should be focusing on what people have a right to access, which is abortion care as health care in the United States.
Yeah, yeah. So well said. So many great points there. And, you know, I'm going to move on because that question was taxing for me too.
It was taxing for me to try and articulate and figure out. So I hear you on that. But a great, and I say that like so the things that we do, right? Obviously writing this book was taxing, right? It's, yeah. You know, these are important conversations, even as they're heavy and even as they can be hard. And I, of course, I want to make sure, you know, that I'm not suggesting that I don't, you know, I actually didn't even talk about this, but I actually grew up Jehovah's Witness. And so, yeah. You know, my own, you know, experience of this from a religious background is fascinating, right? To have grown up Jehovah's Witness, no, you know, very conservative, no sex, no anything. And yeah. Now I write about contraception and abortion, right? It is it's something, right? So I want to make sure that I communicate the nuance, right? That I understand that it's a nuanced thing. That's the part that's a bit of a struggle for me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's understood. So I wanted to end our conversation talking about France, one of my favorite European countries, you know, because they just made abortion a constitutional right just a few weeks ago. And that's really important. But I want to talk about their kind of, you know, the arc of getting to this place, because they followed us in abortion rights and in reproductive rights, right? Roe v. Wade, I think, was passed in 1973. They didn't decriminalize abortion until 1975. So we were ahead of the curve, right? And I think a lot of people, while they were celebrating this decision in France, and it is something to celebrate, they don't realize that, you know, up until 2001, they limited abortion access to 10 weeks. Right. It was only after 2001 that it was extended to 12 weeks. And then again, it was extended to 14 weeks in 2022. So it took them a long time to get to this point. So it's still at 14 weeks, by the way, but it's just been made a constitutional right. And I bring this up to say that as we envision what Roe v. Wade could be, we should look back at what we accomplished. Because in 1973, to pass Roe v. Wade, with access to abortion being at viability, which depending on, you know, what you look at, it can be between, what, 24 weeks and 28 weeks. We were kind of an outlier in abortion rights in 1973, right? And I want to just put that into context to look at what we can achieve when we come together. And I want to think about what we can do as we envision what the next direction for us in Roe v. Wade is going to be. Like what we did, you know, it's not, we don't have it anymore, but we did something really great and we can do something even further, which is what your book is really all about. Like what can reproductive justice, as we re-envision what Roe v. Wade or whatever we have in the future, whatever it's called, when we envision what that future looks like, can we just be expansive in our imaginations, right?
Absolutely. And I think what when you're talking is just making me think about an essay that we have by Koya White Hat Artichoker, titled Colonization, Resistance, and Indigenous Reproductive Justice. And what Koya articulates in her essay is the idea that even as the Dobbs decision has been horrifying in its consequences and horrifying in its inception, it also provides us with an important opportunity to envision a better, more radical future. And I think when one of the things that was really important for me in putting this book together was seeing the ways that folks across the United States and across domains have long been trying to envision more radical futures, even before the Dobbs decision came down, and envisioning futures in which they could help people even before it could be clear that people were going to need help. And so I'm thinking about an essay that we have in the book where one of our contributors talks about the work that they had been doing in Kentucky to provide people with practical support a decade before the Dobbs decision, where they were developing and screening volunteers and providing information on friendly hotels when people had to go, you know, as people had to go to clinics that were far out, figuring out how they could transport people and transport money and resources safely and organizing with labor unions. And again, this was before the Dobbs decision came down. And one of the, it was such a beautiful quote that makes Astern provides in the essay is she says that abortion seekers are not having a political moment. They are accessing pregnancy care, right? And I think that is one of the things that I continuously return to as I think about what's going on with the Dobbs decision, is that even as folks are experiencing barriers and continue to experience barriers to accessing abortion care, just like Makes Astern and the organization in Kentucky have been doing, folks across the board are trying to think strategically about what to do to change the future of abortion access and to make sure that people have access to the care that they need. And so you see this with innovations over the years in access to medication abortion. You see this with Plan C, I interviewed some of the founders for the book. And you see this with how, again, long before the Dobbs decision, how they created this information campaign to help people understand how they could have access to a medication abortion, where they could find information, find access to medication. And so it's one of those things where, as I think about what's happening with Dobbs, and as you talked about, right, the ways that the United States was ahead of the curve in the past, I also think about the ways that people on the ground have fought to be ahead of the curve, even when the Dobbs decision came down, even before the Dobbs decision came down, and how their work can lead the way for us to think about how we can change things to try and think more radically and innovatively moving forward so that we can have a better future for abortion that includes access to abortion, ideally as soon as possible for folks that are lacking it, but recognizing that this has been a long fight and we just have to keep fighting it.
Well, Dr. Crystal E. Littlejohn, I just want to thank you again. This book is truly a gift, right? I'm holding it here and I'm thinking, like, I will read this again and again. It's such an incredible read, right? And you're just such an incredible person to talk to and have this conversation with. But, you know, thank you for bringing this to the world. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. And also thank you so much to all of the folks doing such important work and for the folks that talked with us and shared their pieces with us so that we could let the world know about what they were doing. Thank you all.